There's always been debates about the benefits of aid to developing countries. Does it create dependence? Does it undermine local businesses? Stifle entrepreneurship? Can aid be done well? And what sort of aid works best? But how do you work out the answer to a hypothetical question of what if there was no aid? In today's globalised economy, are there any developing countries that have not been the beneficiaries of aid and loans from, well, institutions like the World Bank? Our next guest believes she has found somewhere that is pretty close. Somaliland declared independence from Somalia in 1991, but has not been recognised by the international community as an independent state. So it doesn't receive aid and intervention, or didn't, certainly in the critical early years. Sarah Phillips, welcome back to the program. Sarah has been researching the country for many years, and her book on her findings is called When There Was No Aid, War and Peace in Somaliland, and it's published by Cornell University Press. Sarah is an associate professor in international security and development in the Department of Government and International Relations at the University of Sydney. And she is also the SOAR Fellow, S-O-A-R Fellow, and non-resident fellow at the Sana Centre for Strategic Studies in Yemen. First of all, please, Sarah, a quick overview, the geographical location, the political significance, and the history of this recently born country.
Hi, Philip. So Somaliland is a really interesting case, as you say. It's located just across the Red Sea from Yemen in the northwest of Somalia. And as you say, it claimed its independence in 1991, but that's never been recognised by any other state. It was part of the British Empire, but it was more peripheral to the British Empire than was the rest of Somalia, which was part of the Italian Empire. In 1960, when the British and the Somalis left, the two states unified after 5 days of independence for Somaliland. And that 5 days that they were independent for has gained almost mythical status. They were recognised by 34 members of the United Nations. And after that, they voluntarily left their independent state and joined with the Republic of Somalia, which they pretty quickly regretted. By 1969, the civilian government within Somalia was overthrown by a military dictator, General Siad Barre. And that began just over 30 years of pretty brutal military dictatorship. Much of that brutality was focused on the northwest of the country, which is where Somaliland is. And it culminated in this dreadful bombing campaign that's widely remembered as being a genocide by Somalilanders. Now, during the early years of Somaliland's proclaimed independence from the rest of Somalia, there wasn't a great deal happening geopolitically in the Horn of Africa. You know, the world was preoccupied with everything else that was going on, with the end of the communist regime in the Soviet Union. But of course, the conflict in Somalia attracted a lot of attention and a lot of Western military aid. And also from the United Nations as well. And the civil war that kicked off there in 1991 attracted a huge amount of interest from the rest of the world. But what was going on in Somaliland, which of course was refused to be considered part of the rest of Somalia, really didn't garner much interest or attention from the rest of the world. And what's really interesting about it is that you've got a case of a civil war going on that nobody else is really trying to either perpetuate or gain or end or gain any benefit from. And that really marks Somaliland out as quite different to the rest of Somalia and to the rest of the developing part of the world.
Can you explain to me why they were never recognized, apart from that initial moment in history, why they were not recognized by the UN or other nations?
This comes down to UN politics, basically, or to and to global politics. Basically, you've had in Africa two states successfully claim independence from a state, and that is Eritrea from Ethiopia, and then more recently South Sudan from Sudan. But what happened in both of those cases was the country from which they were seceding signed off on it. Eventually, it was a long and bloody process, but eventually they consented to the secession of the new state. That has never, and I would submit, will never happen in the case of Somaliland and Somalia. Mogadishu will not allow Somaliland to secede. And so that's basically the difference, that the international community doesn't want to lead on a case of secession, particularly in Africa, where it's feared by many that this could lead to something of a Pandora's box with more and more cases of secession coming to the fore.
I've got to ask you a very simple question. What's the population?
Ooh, that's actually a really political question. It's the latest census that was done by the UN in 2014 suggested that it was around about 4 million, but this created outrage in other parts of Somalia, particularly Puntland, because there was this competition over, you know, an unstated competition, of course, over which entity had more people living in it. And Somaliland was quite pleased that it showed that it, in fact, had more residents.
Now, let me ask you this. Is religion a divisive issue, or is it simply inter-clan conflict?
The clan has been the more salient aspect in the conflicts throughout Somalia's history than has religion, because it's fairly monoreligious. Islam is the religion across all of Somalia. So that hasn't really contributed to conflict. But clan is this really fuzzy category in a lot of ways as well. In Somaliland, people have said that, well, the fact that they're all from one clan family has really contributed to their ability to maintain peace. But actually, you've had inter-clan rivalries that contributed to war as well. And the same thing can be said for Somalia. You can have clan identity either contributing to conflict or helping to ameliorate conflict. So it is a factor, but not in the binary or automatic way that we often tend to think about it.
It's interesting that there's quite a lot of local things to try and keep cohesion. For example, you talk about an arms buyback funded by local businessmen. And when there are major elections, often the candidates are very careful not to inflame the situation.
That's right. So there was a case in 2003 of an unbelievably close presidential election in Somaliland where the incumbent won initially by 80 votes. That was later changed to about 270 votes, but that was out of 500,000 cast. And it was very tense. You know, people were still very much aware of what was still going on in Somalia. And people were very frightened that this could lead to a reignition of the civil war that Somaliland had only left about 6 or 7 years previously. And the talk was all about, you know, could this start war again? But what actually happened was the political leaders on both sides of the election were really, really cautious about this. And they used rhetoric along the lines of, look, we do not want to go down the road that Mogadishu has gone on, and we have to be exceptionally careful about this. This is really, really dangerous for us. And what you had then was this idea that Somaliland exists in a space that is very, very close to violence. And so that made it even more important to publicly disavow the possibility of moving back into war. And so one of the arguments that I make is that it's this closeness to war, this closeness to violence that is really kept alive in the way that people articulate their national experience that's been really important in upholding peace.
So here we have a country which is excluded from international banking, excluded from postage systems, doesn't get access to international aid, heavens above, and yet you argue this has been good for them.
It's a controversial question, and they do now get access to aid, but not in the traditional way that aid is usually delivered to developing states. But certainly in the first 10 years when Somaliland was embroiled in and negotiating its way out of its civil wars, there was almost no aid to speak of. And when you compare that to what was going on in the rest of Somalia, where you had the UN and the US combined spending about $4 billion trying to stabilize, trying to build peace, trying to reinvigorate government institutions, compared to, from what I could tell, about $100,000 that went into the peace process in Somaliland. That's a dramatically different situation. A lot of Somalilanders will say that the lack of aid having gone into the country was actually a blessing in disguise. And it meant that instead of negotiating their peace in, you know, five-star hotels in Nairobi and Geneva and wherever, as was the case for much of the Somali process, they negotiated theirs under trees, which is a phrase that when you're doing interviews, you hear time and time again. We negotiated our peace under the shade of the trees. And they promote this to articulate the fact that they really are very proud that they did this by their own hand and that autonomous recovery from conflict is entirely possible.
What a wonderful paradox that the fragility of the peace is a factor in its success and the awareness that no one is coming to help them.
Yeah, that's something that you hear people talk about all the time as well, this self-reliance, the fact that they did this, they negotiated their own peace by their own hand, and that's what holds it together. But there's also this very, to me, it was quite palpable realization that it hangs in the balance. And it's almost the fact that it hangs in the balance that helps it to sustain itself. It's sort of this weird paradox that people are aware of and concerned about. What happens then if aid or external money does start to come into the country? Will it really upset the apple cart? And that is, of course, what's happening at the moment.
And, of course, the memory of war and its ongoing presence keeps it at bay. It's in the collective consciousness.
It is. You've got memorials to the war all around the country in the main cities. The highway down from Hargeisa to the port city in Berbera is just lined with old, decaying, rusting Soviet-era tanks that have just been left there. And my view is that they are left there as a very powerful reminder of, look what can happen. You've got war memorials all throughout the city of Hargeisa. War is mentioned, or peace is mentioned rather, six times in the constitution. That's pretty unusual. It's the national anthem is about peace and the idea that peace is what sustains Somaliland. There is a really clear effort to keep the idea of peace alive and well in the way that people understand their daily existence.
The next time you're there, will you pass on the news that Late Night Live has recognised them as a nation?
They'll be thrilled.
But the trouble is, Somalia will never willingly give them up.
That's right. They have refused time and time again, and that's just not – they view Somaliland's claim of independence as treasonous and nothing short of treasonous. There is no indication that they will change their view on consenting to secession by Somaliland.
Are there skirmishes?
Very rarely. Any skirmishes that happen have been between Somaliland and Puntland, which is the part of Somaliland that Somaliland borders. There's probably been about, we don't know exactly, but say 200 to 300 soldiers killed in the last 20 years or so in skirmishes over the border. But by and large, there hasn't been a large military confrontation between Mogadishu and Somaliland.
Are there other factors that stretch back to colonial days? For example, are their institutions stronger than in Somalia because they were colonised by the Brits rather than the Italians?
That is a paradoxical part of the narrative that you hear a lot from Somalilanders. So on the one hand, they're very proud that they have developed by their own hand and they've created this really quite remarkable political system without any real tangible external assistance. And yet then you hear this, sometimes this colonial aspect coming into the narrative that they were able to do this because the British left their informal institutions, their clan institutions, largely intact. Somaliland wasn't particularly important to the British Empire in the way that Somalia was important to the Italian Empire. And so you had the Italians taking a much more hands-on and destructive involvement in the clan structures. Now, that's not to excuse the British from this at all. Their time in Somaliland was also very damaging, but it comes through in the way that Somalilanders like to draw this distinction between us and them. Them being the other Somalis. And so they'll say things like, you know, we have a very British respect for the rule of law, whereas the Italian, the Somalis, they have this sort of mafiosa style of political engagement. It's a very pejorative way that they use that.
I know it's hard for you to research outside the cities, but there must be people in Somaliland that don't want autonomy or independence.
Absolutely. There's by the best estimate I could come across was probably about 30% or so of people who are quite opposed to it. And they tend to exist on the border areas, sort of the border with Puntland and the border with Djibouti. But their views are quite marginalized. One time I was giving a public talk in Hargeisa, and I'd written a paper that mentioned this figure of about 30%. And I'd said that, you know, sometimes you will hear elites in the capital city saying that they don't really think that independence is a good idea. And people really questioned me on that. They'd read the piece, which was fairly obscure at the time, and they'd read it, and they came and they had big questions about, you know, why would you say this? Who are these people you're talking about? Like, it was a very contentious issue to be suggesting that there would be some within Somaliland that don't want independence. But actually, there are quite a lot who do not think that independence is in the best interest of Somaliland politically or economically.
Now, before I let you go, I mentioned in the intro that you're an expert in Yemen. So is there anything in your research that could be applied to that conflict?
A lot, yes. So you hear Yemenis saying commonly now, look, if we were able to negotiate our peace without such a strong international hand, without such a strong expectation that it was going to adhere to specific milestones and specific international or institutional endpoints, we'd be doing a lot better. There is a very strong feeling that the international presence there is hampering Yemenis' ability to negotiate peace amongst themselves. Actually, Yemenis are very good negotiators. And if you look at their history of conflict in the modern era, it's really only the conflicts that have had a strong international presence that have dragged on for a long time. That is the war that came after 1962 and what we're seeing now.
So a little bit of benign neglect. Look, Sarah, thank you very much for that. Associate Professor Sarah Phillips, Department of Government and International Relations at the University of Sydney. The book, When There Was No Aid, War and Peace in Somaliland, and that's published by Cornell University Press. Oh, heavens above, stop the press. Sarah's book just been awarded the very posh CRISP Prize by the Australian Political Studies Association. Good on you, Sarah.